Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
The following episode contains biblical discourse and theological interpretation. The views expressed are my own and represent a personal reading of Scripture intended for narrative and analytical purposes within the context of this discussion. This is not a definitive or doctrinal teaching, and listeners are encouraged to engage critically and explore these themes further according to their own beliefs and understandings. Viewer discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Five Nights at Freddy's podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you so much for listening. In my time of analyzing Five Nights at Freddy's, I have always spoken at length of the importance of viewing the series from a narrative lens. While the series may have begun as a grand puzzle, with elusive steps to uncover the treasure that was promised at the conclusion of the mystery. After a decade has passed, the series has expanded into a more traditional narrative journey, still with its own quirks and charms that we love. Sometimes, but no longer is there any obfuscation on the who, the what, and the when of the purple guy, the missing children's incident, or the night guard's motives. Secrets still linger, and FNAF, like life, is not replete with answers. But the story itself is well known, at least in terms of Scott Cawthon's Golden Age material. But if there is one key aspect that no theorist, content creator, or whichever title you give to those who inspect and attempt to be an orator for the lore and story of Scott's 10 years of work of blood and gears tend to discuss, it would be the meta-narrative. We talk at lengths of the symbolic meaning behind such things as the 8-bit minigames, or the implications of colors and characters tied to their metaphoric meaning in terms of the lore. But what of the deeper themes? What of the moral framework that built the foundation of the story? And what are we supposed to take away from and inspire us with through the art? I have always believed that an artist's work always holds an underlying meaning, a grander purpose than that of the artist themselves may not even comprehend that exist. For the difference between art and propaganda is the values and beliefs of the man or woman holding the pen. The stage in which the artist lets his creativity and imagination dance, perform, and play. While propaganda puts the moral or ideological compass at the forefront. What should be foundational takes the spotlight, and as a result, the stage the performance is built on is hollow and collapses under the weight of the pretend artist's own hubris. Scott Cawthon in Five Nights at Freddy's is no different in this regard. Similar to the work of C.S. Lewis, the man was a talented writer and creator of fantastical worlds Get Lost In as well, but this world was built on foundation of his Christian belief. The familiar saying, "Every story has been told," is often a mockery made by nihilists to drag others down to the abyss of which they find themselves being consumed by. Like frogs who feel the temperature of the pot rising, so they pull down the others, so that they all may suffer a slow death equally. But it is also an anxious belief of creatives and writers who yearn for adventure, but don't know where to set their sails. Born too late to explore the seas. Born too early to explore the stars. The natural state of humanity is to yearn for adventure. We are naturally explorers of all things and constantly looking for answers to our questions. But those answers almost indirectly result in two new questions being found and thus two new adventures that must be taken upon. Yes, every story has been told. But that's to say that every speck of the earth has been walked. Every man, woman, and child has walked the same path. Foundational stories, those often found in holier work, are the foundational works that much of the great works of Western society can be traced back to. And as such, it is important, even if you aren't religious, to look in these holy texts, not just for C.S. Lewis or Tolkien, but Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Dostoevsky, Oscar Wilde, and yes, I do believe, Scott Cawthon. Laugh as you will that I can compare Scott to those other highly acclaimed authors, but the truth in the matter is that he does share some similarities to them. And in the previous realm of discussion of how no new stories have been told, there is something to be said of Scott Cawthon being the first to develop the mascot horror genre, a decision born from his imagination through trial, ridicule, and the lowest point in his life, the death of his artistic dreams. Rewarded for taking one last voyage on those risky waters. And he was rewarded bountifully. But those riches then casted a scent that others immediately picked up. Others who didn't understand why it is that Scott's work, even as simple and made from scratch as it was, resonated with so many people. Bendy and the Ink Machine, Poppy's Playtime, Indigo Park, all of them follow the same formulaic story that Scott had developed. Corrupt children entertainment establishment, colorful mascot characters that seek to destroy rather than inspire, and some form of acolyte of Satan who acts as the catalyst for pursuing action solely for their own gain, whether it be for their pride, ego, lust for power, or for some reason always trying to cheat death. But none have ever yet truly resonated as much as Scott Cawthon's work. Even divided as the franchise audience is now, from narrative, gameplay direction, and world-building and franchise management, which I have spoken ad infinitum of, people still talk about William Afton, Golden Freddy begrudgingly, and Michael Afton. It still remains the de facto king of this new territory it has explored. A righteous king at that. For even in its failings, it has yet to truly ever lose sight of what made the story so successful. Endless exploration, stories of sacrifice and second chances, and the battles of good and evil, chaos and order, even if it is on a much smaller scale in comparison to, say, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, or even The Dark Knight. So if you will indulge me, I would like to take a moment to explore Five Nights at Freddy's in, how some may interpret it, a more biblical allusionary framework, and see what we are able to yield from it.
The story of Cain and Abel.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn, author of The Gulag Archipelago, once wrote that, quote, "The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart, and through all human hearts. This line shifts. Inside us, it oscillates with the years, and even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridget of good is retained." One of the more iconic stories of the Bible comes from Cain and Abel, the story of two brothers born from Adam and Eve. When it came to offer sacrifices to God, Abel offered the best of his flock, while Cain offered some of his crops. God favored Abel's offering, but rejected Cain's. This rejection angered Cain, and despite God's warning to control his emotions, Cain's jealousy consumed him, leading to Cain luring Abel into the field and murdering him. When God asked for Cain an explanation, Cain shook his fist at God for not showing him due respect, but in response, God shook his head. Cain had blamed God for his problems before, but God had warned him that he had let sin lie at his door and let it have its way with him, a warning Cain had not heeded. God explained that Cain had never fully sacrificed, whereas Abel gave his all. Abel always offered the fattest livestock, the ripest offering, whereas Cain offered the weakest hull in the most worthless of his yield. Cain only tried to get by with what little he needed to give. In response to his little effort, God, the entity of the highest good, in the embodiment of the spirit of adventure, the goal of self-sacrifice, and the bringer of order to chaos, rebuked Cain, whom fled to Nod, a Hebrew word for wander or exile. Because to deny God's existence, to blame him for the failings of the self, and to reject the teachings of morality and hierarchical valuement order, is to live a life of wander and self-exile, a life of unfulfillment, with no purpose, no place, in essence, no life, for no effort. Adam and Eve then bore a third child in Seth. Seth, whom God gave to them as a replacement for Abel, and is considered the beginning of the holy bloodline that starts from him, the son of the first humans of the fallen race of man, to eventually generations later, to Noah, who would be the designated survivor of the great flood that God brought upon the world when the spirit of Cain infected every heart, mind, and soul of man on earth, flooding their thoughts with murder, treachery, sedition, and debauchery. But even in that preserved bloodline, the spirit of Cain crept, as Noah's son, Ham, would bring shame by finding mockery and slights to his father when he was at his most vulnerable. Ham's descendants, particularly through his grandson Nimrod, are traditionally associated with the founding of Babylon, the city that sought to reach the heavens through human effort and pride. But the people of Babel did not place a god at their hearts in this endeavor. Rather, it was their pride, ego, and desire to ascend to the divide that drove their actions, repeating man's original sin from the Garden of Eden. Though God intervened by confusing their language and scattering them across the earth, their downfall was already inevitable. For any place where the spiritual lineage of Cain takes roots and holds, where resentment, moral defiance, and self-idolatry reign without mercy, collapse follows as a natural consequence. In the pursuit of freedom from moral scrutiny, the promise to indulge every whim and sensation as though entitled by divine right, societies may rise, but the world, the city, the tower they build, will eventually erode, decay, or fall to ruin. This is a brief summary and translation of the spiritual lineage of Cain, a pattern of human rebellion and self-destruction echoed throughout biblical history, and it flows directly into the narrative I wish to explore. Again, as I said in my disclaimer, this isn't a religious lecture, but the conversation of these stories flows directly into the narrative I wish to explore. I've said before, in my Remnant and Agony episode, that William and Michael embody agony and remnant, their symbolic significance, both metaphorically and in some ways almost literally. By extension, William can be seen not only as the embodiment of agony, but also an avatar of the spirit of Cain, a soul of resentment, envy, and pride, violence, aimlessness, and the forging of one's own moral compass while rejecting the divine values of the moral good. A journey for which is nothing more than an eternal downward spiral into the abyss.
William and Henry, Resentment and Envy.
One of the earliest explored facets of William Afton's character in the Silverized novel trilogy is his deep-seated resentment toward his business partner Henry Emily. Further expanded upon in The Fourth Closet, this bitterness stems from William's fury upon discovering that Henry had uncovered something truly miraculous. Remnant. A means of, in a sense, cheating death. The murder of Charlotte was born from his envy against Henry's creative brilliance and the subsequent disappearance of the children at Freddy's. A calculated attempt to dismantle Henry's legacy, even as William himself spiraled into grief and madness. This narrative arc echoes the biblical story of Cain and Abel, a cautionary tale rooted in resentment, even toward one's own blood. Yet the driving force behind Cain's act of fratricide extends beyond mere jealousy. It reflects a deeper disillusionment with society's structure, the belief that one's labor should yield greater favor, and the refusal to accept that the fault may lie not in divine injustice or the whim of the universe, but in one's own choices. Now, let us consider the concept of society within the Cain and Abel story. At first glance, invoking society may seem, well, absurd. After all, the world at the time consisted of just four people. But when viewed from a symbolic lens, the roles begin to embody broader societal functions. Abel is a shepherd, a figure that the Bible repeatedly elevates as emblematic of virtue and heroism. David, the humble shepherd boy who defeats Goliath. And Jesus, who refers to himself as the Good Shepherd, one who lays down his life for his flock, are two such archetypes. The shepherd's role is often misconstrued as merely guiding livestock to pasture, but more profoundly, it is that of vigilant guardianship, one who defends the vulnerable from threats far greater than themselves, even at the cost of their own safety and sometimes life. In society, certain roles naturally garner a higher degree of respect, almost by instinct. Take, for example, the soldier who lays down their life in defense of their homeland. Such sacrifice evokes a deep reverence, not merely because of the duty fulfilled, but because of the immense personal cost accrued. The same holds true for police officers, firefighters, first responders, and doctors. Individuals who commit themselves to arduous, often perilous callings that serve the greater good. These are professions rooted in nobility and service, and thus we, as a collective, are inclined to show them honor, due respect, and awash them with accolades. Slight tangent, creatives occupy a more ambiguous space. Throughout history, artists have also inspired change, uplifted the human spirit, and shaped the course of civilizations. Yet, just as many have wielded the mantle of artist to provoke, to destroy, or to justify malicious intent under the guise of expression or change, it is a field that welcomes visionaries, but also, unfortunately, is a breeding ground of pretenders and propagandists. Abel, as a shepherd, embodies the archetype of the guardian. His is a thankless, dangerous vocation, warding off threats, braving nature's cruelty, and bearing the burden of protecting those who cannot protect themselves. And yet, despite these hardships, Abel offers to God, the embodiment of the highest good, the fattest and most unblemished of his flock. He doesn't cut corners. He doesn't seek the easy way out. His sacrifice is the product of both discipline and devotion. Contrast this with Cain, who labors in the fields. A simpler job, but by no means a meaningless endeavor. On the contrary, it is vital. But Cain presents God with the most withered and meager of his harvest. He meets the bare minimum of what is required, but with no genuine effort, no striving for excellence in putting in more. The offering is symbolic of a hollow gesture, a task done not out of reverence, but obligation, and only ever striving to achieve what is required, and not to go above and beyond the call of duty. And notice how I did not claim Cain's work was unimportant, only that it was simpler. The role of the farmer is essential and important, just as Abel's is. Both contribute to the sustenance and betterment of their world. But the distinction lies in the level of risk and sacrifice. Abel places himself in danger daily, at the mercy of nature and the threat of predators. Cain, by contrast, operates in a more orderly, controlled environment. Both roles matter. Both sustain life and make the world better. But the risk they assume, and by extension in this example, the individual heart behind their actions, are what ultimately differentiate the recognition they receive. It's the same way we may revere a soldier coming home from war with tears of joy. But when the farmer reports his harvest, we shake his hand and congratulate him. But if the soldier were to lord over his superiority as a warrior who almost lost his life over a humble farmer, well, the soldier would no longer be in our good graces from his selfish egotism, now would he? Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit legally.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Henry Emily was the creative force, the visionary. He wasn't merely the engineer behind the machines. He was the mind that conceived Fredbear's singing show, the diner, the atmosphere, the brand itself. It was Henry who poured his creative spirit into the foundation of a place built on joy, wonder, and the simple magic of family spending quality time with one another and building cherished memories. He took the risks, both financially and personally, to bring that dream to life. William Afton, by contrast, represented the business side. His contributions were logistical, managerial, vital, yes, but ultimately detached from the imaginative soul and risk of the enterprise. William did not conceive the heart of Fredbear's. Rather, he ensured its operational functionality. His talents could be applied to any number of ventures, interchangeable with other business pursuits if profitability so demanded. And so, when it comes to public respect and name recognition, who do you think the world remembers for the idea of Fredbears? Henry. He was the risk taker, the dreamer, and while William's role was essential, he would never receive the same admiration for his business acumen as Henry would for his creative legacy. William Afton, at his core, is a sociopathic, egomaniac, driven by a desperate thirst for power, control, and reverence. Though the yearning to be revered and respected borders a fine line with the desire to be feared and notorious. We catch glimpses of this pathology in Midnight Motorist, where his household is ruled with a tyrant's grip. His own son, a boy who should have looked to him as a guardian against the harshness of the world, endures a man who brings those harsh realities to home. Oh, how strong of a man you are, William, to raise your hand against your own blood, to a child who instinctively sees you as a protector, but instead finds in you the very thing he should be protected from. It's a fitting pattern for a man as cowardly as William Afton, a man who preys on children, the most vulnerable, the most impressionable, the most defenseless, those who are easy to frighten, to manipulate, to isolate, and to tear apart. That is the true measure of his power, one built not on strength or greatness, but on his charismatic prowess in exploiting those least able to fight back. The death of Charlotte is the symbolic equivalent of Cain slaughtering Abel's ripest sacrifice, the offering meant to represent his dedication to the highest good. It's as if Cain, in his bitterness, had killed the finest sheep of the flock, not to take from God, but to prove a point, that the shepherd is fallible, incapable of protecting what is most sacred to his duty. William's murder of Charlotte is just that, a cruel gesture meant to mock Henry's role not only as a creator, but as a protector. It is a direct assault on the very image of the shepherd, a father raising his daughter to become a kind, capable, and beautiful human being. With his daughter taken away from him, Henry is distracted, wounded, and in his pain, fails to see the wolf hiding among the flock. The killer moves freely, claiming more victims while the shepherd grieves. Henry earned his respect, not just as a businessman or even as a father, but as a man. He labored honestly, admitted his flaws later in life, and bore the weight of his choices without redirecting blame. William Afton, on the other hand, as depicted throughout the novels, wallowed in envy. His personal writings about Henry veer wildly between fawning admiration and violent resentment. Why? Because William believed he deserved more. And like a petulant child consumed by jealousy, he reasoned, "If I cannot have the praise or recognition I deserve, then no one will." Venturing briefly into theory territory, I believe it's important to consider how Michael Afton and William's wife factor into this narrative of desperate validation. Based on the implications of The Immortal and the Restless, and the new game release of Secret of the Mimic, Michael was likely born in the 1970s, potentially out of wedlock. The timeline hints that William and his wife may have separated for a time, with Michael being born during this estranged period. Contrast that with Henry, whose family life appears stable and affectionate in the novelization, and whose love for Charlotte is undeniable, both in the fourth closet, a bit maniacally so, and Freddy Fazbear's pizzeria simulator. Henry exemplifies the image of a proud father, a man who succeeds not only in business, but had the aptitude to achieve similar results in love and parenthood. William Afton, meanwhile, is marked by emotional estrangement, volatility, and a seemingly dysfunctional marriage. If Michael was indeed born during a time of marital instability, William may have seen the child not as a symbol of hope, but as a reminder of failure, a union forged not by love, but obligation, a mistake, a stigma. In the 1970s, such circumstances were often met with societal judgment, casting shadows over one's character and status. And perhaps it's no surprise, then, that William, likely driven to drink, confirmed to be driven to violence, and to spiraling rage, found a perverse sense of justification in targeting Henry. He attacked the one thing that defines a father more than any public accolade: his child. To desecrate that bond, to destroy what makes you a father, is to strike at the heart of a man's identity. And for someone like William, that was a delicious irony he could not help but gorge himself on, and eventually become addicted to repeat.
William Afton and the Fun Times. Pride and intelligence.
It is often said that a tool is neither inherently good nor evil, but instead acts as an extension, an amplifier, of the moral character of its wielder. A gun, for instance, is a terrifying weapon, yet there is a stark difference between a six-shooter in the hands of a Wild West outlaw and the same weapon wielded by a sheriff or marshal striving to preserve order in the chaos of the frontier. For a more literary example, consider the eponymous portrait in The Picture of Dorian Gray, a painting that bore the burden of sin on behalf of its subject. Each stroke of depravity etched itself not upon Dorian's face, but onto the canvas. Had this canvas been wielded by a wise man, the painting could have served as a moral compass, a visual reminder of one's descent into vice. But instead, Dorian concealed it, hid the evidence of his shame, and squandered the gift of eternal youth to indulge in aestheticism, vice, and momentary delights that, at best, are hollow, and at worst, bleed darkness into both self and others. The spirit of Cain is the infernal whisper that murmurs, "Life has denied you what you deserve. Take revenge, then, upon existence itself." It is a spirit of ruination, and its target is always the innocent. It feeds on resentment and finds its aperture in the very tool meant to better our world, our own technology. There is a peculiar obsession with technology among those unhappy with their own choices, a false belief that, rather than transforming themselves or refining their worldview, they can instead build something powerful enough to reshape reality itself, not to serve the good, but to dominate it and to control it. In Dante's Inferno, the deepest circle of hell is not a lake of fire, but a frozen abyss, Cocytus, where Satan gnaws internally upon history's greatest traitors, Cassius, Brutus, and Judas. fire, the traditional symbol of punishment, is replaced with ice to convey a far greater sin. Betrayal. Not merely betrayal of people, but of trust, of love, of the sacred potential found within humanity. It is cold because betrayal is the antithesis of warmth, the death of communal faith in favor of isolated, self-serving treachery. Betrayal, pride, and intellect share a common root in resentment. Cain was not just angry with Abel, he was angry with God for not recognizing his offering, for not crowning his efforts with glory. In this light, pride is not merely a vice, but the gateway drug to corruption. The proud man is wounded by any evidence that he is not the best, not the smartest, not the strongest, and not the most respected. So it is with William Afton. His pride is fragile, and his resentment festers when he is outshone. Socially, by Henry Emily, intellectually, by Edwin Murray, and even morally, by his own son Michael. Like Cain, William cast himself as the victim of an unjust world, and in this twisted victimhood, he seeks retribution, not against a person, but against the very concept of goodness these three men represented. If he cannot possess the joy he envies, then he will destroy it. Again, this is why the lowest pit of hell is cold. Betrayal is the absence of warmth, of love, and all that binds people together. It is self-imposed exile through radical individuation, where the good of many is discarded for the bitter pleasure of one. The Funtime animatronics are the culmination of everything William Afton represents: cold, calculating, and treacherous. They are more than machines. They are avatars of his Luciferian ego and sadistic imagination. It wasn't enough for him to exploit the mascots of childhood wonder as costumes for his own atrocities. No, he engineered automatons to carry out his will, to wear the smile of innocence while holding blades behind their metal bones. Circus Baby and Funtime Freddy represent both sides of Afton's depravity. Circus Baby is the face of manipulation, the embodiment of shattered trust, the underminer of relationships once believed to be unbreakable. She seduces, lies, and betrays, discarding others the moment they outlive their usefulness. When denied control, she turns vindictive and petty and petulant. Funtime Freddy, on the other hand, is Afton's perverse intellectualism, curious, theatrical, and homicidally fascinated with death. In Count the Ways, he doesn't merely kill. He experiments. He philosophizes. He admires the artistry of how a human can physically suffer as the bone meal runs out, as one might admire the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. It is evil under the guise of intellectual curiosity, experimentation, and yet, paradoxically, the perceived appropriate punishment for the crimes of other he deem unworthy of life. Pride of the Creator, betrayal of the kin, and the dark intelligence of the creation. This is the Trinity of William Afton. This is the legacy of the monster who wears the wide smile of man.
The Missing Children Incident. Violence and Debauchery.
In the picture of Dorian Gray, Dorian's descent into hedonism finds its moral justification after the tragic death of Sybil Vane, his young actress fiancée. After cruelly discarding her when she fails to meet his aesthetic expectations on stage, Sybil takes her own life. Rather than being overcome with guilt, Doreen is quickly comforted by Lord Henry, his friend, who reframes the tragedy as a beautiful experience, an artistic moment rather than a moral failing on himself. Lord Henry encourages Doreen to view it not as a loss, but a rare and poetic indulgence in youthful passion. It is here that Doreen begins to fully embrace a worldview that rationalizes self-indulgence, cruelty, and sin as justified. Through that world lens, life and soul becomes a playground of hedonism or destruction. Because if nothing matters, then all that does is what is to be experienced and pleasured. You see, when Cain murders his brother and rejects all that is good, all that is true, and all that is harmful to himself to atone for, the natural next step from violence is more violence. But it isn't just about murder. It's about nihilism and decadence and the pursuit of power. And in that pursuit, any justification for violence isn't a righteous one. It's an impulsive need. William Afton knows what he is doing is wrong. He is well aware that killing children is perhaps one of the greatest evils a man can carry out. But William also knows that all those moral reasons don't apply to him. The reason why he chooses to kill children is because of the sanctity the world puts on their innocence and their defenselessness. To trick, to hurt, and to ultimately kill a child is relatively easy. But in their desperate cries, they perform a serenade that a psychopathic, homicidal man like William adores. Nothing is more ripe and succulent than that of the desecration of purity to that man, marring the world in darkness, even where it should shine its most bright. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
The Dead Children Incident and Spring Trap. Aimlessness and Spite.
Henry the Father, Edwin the Creative Spirit, and Michael the Risen Man, and the innocence and purity of childhood are the idols of William's story. These are the characters and avatars who represent the ideals upon which the moral world rests. They represent guardianship, inspiration, redemption, and hope. But the spirit of Cain is not merely resistant to these virtues. It is their antithesis. It is the embodiment of betrayal, of corrupted pride, of resentment so deep it seeks to unmake what is good simply because it cannot possess it. And for such a sin, God speaks to Cain, quote, "So now you are cursed from this earth, which had opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt that be in the earth." End quote. Genesis 4:11, 12. In the same manner that Dorian Gray could never sever his soul from the weight of his immoral deeds, Cain too cannot elude the consequences of his transgression. Nothing born of his labor shall prosper. All he creates will wither, and he will be condemned to wander, a fugitive cloaked in shame, a thief in the night. Such is the fate of the man who slays and defiles the highest ideal, who betrays purity, desecrates innocence, and mocks the sacred. So too is the path of William Afton. Upon the death of his daughter and the revelation to the board that his creations were not faulty, but instruments of death. Not like the mimic absorbing Edwin's rage, but working as intended to murder without leaving a trace. William was cast out, stripped of his company, no family he loves or is loved by, bereft of friendship, and barred from the very works that bore his name. He became a man without a legacy. By this point, William Afton is irretrievably lost, and the fault lies with no one but himself. As Cain laments when cast into the land of Nod, so too might William cry, quote, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth," end quote. Genesis 4:14. All those possessed by the spirit of Cain become alienated from others. It is a rare self-fulfilling prophecy. They deceive, they cheat, they steal. They cooperate only when personal gain is assured, and offer others only what is second-rate when asked for aid. Yet no matter how long it takes, the people around them inevitably come to see the truth. Like the society that once adored Dorian Gray, but grew wary as rumors of his indulgence in corruption spread, that those in his proximity began to feel poisoned, defiled, drained of all that made them good. And so the wise and wary sever their ties, leaving the deceiver in their isolation. In response, the prideful and arrogant grow bitter and vengeful, like a second-rate carnival forced to move from town to town. As each village uncovers its fraudulence, they must seek out new territories to exploit, new souls to drag down with them. For as the saying goes, misery loves company. The second missing children's incident, also known as the dead children incident, has always stood as an anomaly in William Afton's otherwise calculated methodology. Gone is the meticulous stalking from afar, the patient identification of the vulnerable prey, the subtle luring of the sheep away from the flock. In its place, he embeds himself within the system as a security guard, tampers with the toy animatronic's facial recognition to open a window of opportunity. And when he finally acts, he does so brazenly, in full view in broad daylight. It should go without saying that the manipulation and murder of a child is one of the most horrific of crimes. But there is something even more terrifying about the savage rampage of a man who, unbound from any purpose or pretense, acts with pure bloodlust, indiscriminately, unapologetically, in full view of those who scream and run in vain. Like Funtime Freddy in Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria Simulator, who shift from intelligent animatronic to beast fueled by feral instinct reveals a horrifying duality, William Afton too has devolved. The death of Charlotte marked his point of no return, yet it was the collapse of everything he had built that severed the last tether to his calculated persona. Left with no grander scheme, no more masks to wear, the man disintegrates into something far worse. A monster without purpose. Now, his only drive is slaughter. For power, for dominion, for the godlike thrill of deciding who lives and dies. He seeks not redemption nor resolution, only the certainty that he will be remembered. And for the psychopath who can no longer create, who can no longer control, what remains is destruction. If he cannot leave his mark upon the world, then he will stain its canvas with blood. And that is the spirit of Cain, embodied through William Afton. William lies habitually. Treachery became his path, and that path led him to infanticide and theft. The destruction of ideals he once only half-heartedly pursued, yet felt entitled to the rewards too. In time, he found himself isolated, shunned by all who had come to know his deceitful nature. His life's work, no matter how ambitious or grand, was doomed to ruin, fated to never bear fruit. This misalignment of values, something that, with enough practice and rationalization, can become second nature to all of us, gives rise to a heart steeped in darkness. It is a lie of despair, a self-deception so complete that it corrupts the soul. And William, in some twisted part of himself, knows it is false. I mean, what does William Afton truly desire to be? A successful businessman? A brilliant inventor? A scientist? An alchemist of life bent on transcending death itself? A monster? Something primal and feared, lurking just beyond the light? To be loved? Feared? Envied? All of the above? When one's worldview is so fundamentally misaligned, when the moral order is inverted and the self is enthroned as God, no plan can succeed, no creation can thrive, and no joy can last. All paths lead only to fleeting, debaucherous pleasures and their inevitable ruin. That is the path, the descent into Dante's abyss. An ever-deepening, ever-widening hell when a man lives falsely, valuing, celebrating, and yearning for what is improper. Nothing can be yielded but misery. All his stories, his adventures, are hollow echoes, false experiences in pursuit of illusory purposes, bequeathing nothing but fleeting impression of meaning. No great work of art to endure, no sacrifices to be remembered, no noble contribution to be honored. The tools he wields are not themselves good or evil, but in the hands of a man with darkness stirring within, they become instruments of misery, cast across the world like a spreading stain. A soul forged in the crucible of pride, resentment, and the worship of intellect over wisdom becomes a dangerous equation, one whose answer is always a threat to humanity. And though we know William Afton as the monster of this story, such a threat is, thankfully, rarely remembered in detail in the real world, like the bear that mauls a hiker or the shark that strikes a surfer. The act is remembered, the violence, the loss, and the victim. But the creature itself fades into myth. No one recalls which bear, which shark, only that a predator struck the innocent. And that is all the agony of such a story truly leaves behind, with the monster itself forgotten into myth. And with all that said, this concludes tonight's program of Into the Night. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to stay updated, please consider subscribing, following, or sharing this podcast. It truly helps us broaden our reach. Consider following us on our Twitter, @FazbearPodcast, joining our Discord, or supporting us on our Patreon or merch store using the various links in the description of this episode. We actually just released a poster of Entered on our Patreon that I think is very, very dope, and I think you will all enjoy taking a look at. I have been your host, Nick Black, and I would like to thank you all once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.